So maybe while we're just sort of settling in, there are two Canadian fashion students trekking in the Rockies, and they come in a clearing and disturb a grizzly, and the grizzly turns round and starts to pursue them, so they hightail it out of there. And all of a sudden one of the students stops, takes off their rucksack, takes out a pair of trainers, no logos mentioned, and starts to put them on. And the other one says, "You don't think you're going to outrun that grizzly with those trainers on?" And he says, "No, I'm going to outrun you." And that, to me, sort of sums up the global textile, footwear and garment industry today. Not just the sportswear industry, but pretty much the global picture, which has been sort of exacerbated, I think, with the expiry of the agreement in textiles and clothing in 2004. But what I want to do today, obviously, is just share with you a little bit about what it is we're trying to achieve with our work. And I think we need to go back a little bit in terms of the structural issues in sportswear, but also in the global sector overall. Like, where is the control in the industry, and where is the control in the Olympic movement? I think the brand representatives here today would probably say it's not a clear-cut thing where the control in the industry is. Kevin mentioned Yu Yen. Yu Yen, correct me if I'm wrong, is probably bigger than some of the brands here in terms of its turnover. The compliance efforts, I would say, sort of result in a sort of cat-and-mouse game. One minute the brand might think it's got control on the compliance effort, then the vendor compliance officers go in and depart, and then it sort of reverts back to how it was before. Now, when we look at the Olympic movement, I find it sort of like unbelievable that the International Olympics Committee still has no control over what's going on in terms of compliance efforts in the different host cities that we have at the moment, and where we've got a complete variation in infrastructure set up in terms of ethical purchasing. You hear me okay? Am I too far away from the mic? Is that right? Yeah? Now, the other thing is, we thought let's set some targets and maybe some deadlines here. We had a big discussion in the campaign group about this. Somebody once said to me, there's no such thing as should. And I thought, and I sort of said to some of the other campaign members, you know, if you want anybody to do something, they should do it from within. You shouldn't be, imposing something from without. But actually, in terms of the way the industry operates, it operates very much in terms of KPIs, or key performance indicators. And so we thought, why shouldn't we extend this to some key social compliance areas? Now, just before I get into where we are at the moment, some of the actual targets you'll find in the Clearing the Hurdles publication, which is downloadable from the Playfair site. And there's actually a summary, a very brief summary, on the centre pages of the Maquila Solidarity update newsletter. But what about the dialogue that we're trying to achieve at a sectoral level? There's a lot of very, very good work going on locally and nationally, but the whole effort of the campaign, the whole drift of the campaign, which began in 2004, was to address things at a sectoral level. In fact, that's nationally what, of course, trade unions have tried to do in a strategic sense, so that the maximum number of people can benefit from the changes that you're trying to bring about. Now, we had two meetings, high-level meetings, if you want to call them that, at the ILO, which I think it's fair to say those people here who were there would probably say they didn't yield much. They were talking shops. We didn't get anywhere with that. And partly it's to do with the fact that one of the convening bodies, the World Federation of Sporting Goods Industry, is in fact a trade association for the industry. It has a code of conduct, but it does not have a compliance function in the organisation. So there's nobody there
if you like, to drive an agenda. The one body that is there that could do something, in which has a number of corporate members, is the Fair Labour Association. But for those of you who are unaware of this organisation, it is not as progressive, we would argue, on the issues of living wage and hours of work, and therefore a number of organisations felt that they couldn't work with the FLA to go down this road. So we got a bit stuck. Now, that's why we're having, at the end of this month, a sectoral conference in Hong Kong, where we're bringing the affiliates of the International Textile Garment Leather Workers Federation, NGOs, and a number of leading brands together to discuss substantive issues for a change, not dance around, but actually get into the four key areas that Kevin mentioned in his presentation, which I want to just go through now in terms of some targets. First of which, freedom of association and collective bargaining. I think one of the big problems with trade union rights, or an observation one could make about trade union rights, is in a sense it's about discrimination. And if you think about some of the efforts we've made nationally around discrimination in other areas, to do with, say, race and sex, we have gone down the path of what I think you would say in North America is affirmative action, what we would say in Europe is positive action, which is a recognition of historical disadvantage. Now, let me try and operationalise this in terms of an actual proposal. I was at a meeting in Thailand, and a worker said to me, you know, all we really need is something to wave at an employer, almost like an insurance policy. And a right to unionise guarantee would be a very, very simple statement that a supplier would underwrite, possibly also a brand could underwrite, but in a sense that's already there in terms of the code of conduct, which says, in the event of any worker trying to organise or join a union in this factory, I, as owner of the factory, hereby undertake not to victimise or discriminate that worker, signed by the factory manager. Okay, it may not change the world, but it might just give workers that little bit more confidence about wanting to join the union. It's something that could hold up like a red card or a yellow card in the event of any untoward behaviour by their factory manager. Got dry just a minute. Must be terror creeping up on me. Anyway, worker training. Big realisation we've made, particularly in China, is that we've got to do a lot of work around worker rights, particularly with if you need to understand the particular makeup, particularly of many of the sportswear factories in China. We're looking at an age group between maybe 18, 25, rural migrant workers, very transient, high levels of turnover. They need to understand what rights they have in that short time that they might be there. And we're also thinking in terms of incentives for suppliers, particularly those who engage in collective bargaining. And what we mean by an incentive would be a promise to maintain production for a significant length of time. Precarious employment. We want, obviously, as Kevin mentioned, to end the abuse of short-time contracts. And we didn't go for a 100% figure because there will be instances where companies do require people in on short-term contracts to do maintenance work or whatever specific skills are required that they don't require on a full-time basis. But we're looking at a figure of 95% of supplier workforces to be on permanent contracts by 2010. And it does tie in with ethical purchasing in terms of what sort of orders and what sort of lead times are being imposed on suppliers that might result in a tendency to use more and more short-term labour. Factory closures. I have to say, I don't really know how much consolidation has gone on in sportswear since the end of the ATC in 2004. I don't know. Maybe some of the brand representatives here could shed some light on that. What we do know is there have been significant closures in countries like Indonesia, in Central America for sure. And one of the interesting initiatives that has been going on, and we couldn't include in the Playfair report because it wasn't ready, but it just in these last 2 days is now ready, is that a number of brands have got together with the labour movement and NGOs to, in a sense, thrash out a set of guidelines on what we call responsible transition. Initially, they were called responsible closure. And we said, for God's sake, we can't. How can you call something responsible closure? There are a series of practices, in a sense, best practices now in terms of how you handle exit strategies and indeed entry strategies in supplier countries. That document is just fresh, and the MFA forum, which is the multi-fiber agreement forum, in which a number of sportswear brands are represented, does now need to concentrate and focus on a programme of work to operationalise that. Living wage, we know this is a contentious area. I think the first thing to say is that a discussion on a living wage is a national activity. It can't be sort of, there can't be some sort of global norm that's centrally dictated by somebody based on some sort of formula. And so we're in the ITG, we've embarked on a national exercise, and we'll have to drive that a bit, and we will be doing that before the Hong Kong event, to get our affiliates to engage with other stakeholders in trying to determine what is a living wage figure for their country. In some cases, it's already happening. But in Bangladesh, some estimates put a living wage figure at 4,800 taka. The current wage is 1,600. The notional living wage that's being used at the moment or being talked about is 3,000. In Cambodia in 2006, the trade union figure of a living wage was about $82. The final settlement moved from 45 to 50. So there's still some way to go. And the big problem is that wage determination, particularly in Asia, is largely done at a national minimum wage fixing level, either by government proclamation or by some tripartite council. And that's always going to orientate itself towards what we call the slow ship in the convoy. In other words, the employers' associations are going to say, well, look, our member firms, the least profitable can only pay this. Oh, and by the way, in Vietnam or in whatever country, the minimum wage is this. If you go up, if you increase it, we're going to get countries pulling out and moving to lower wage countries. So it's absolutely essential that we move on the second point, which is addressing freedom of association and collective bargaining. Because it's at the factory level that you can make up the difference between what's the minimum wage and what should be a living wage, or at least even a wage that the actual company is able to pay. And one of the big problems we have on this issue is lack of transparency. Workers just don't know how much is being earned. They know how much volume is going through the factory. The other frightening point is the sort of unit labour cost on some of these garments that they make compared to what the retail price is. Just want to give you an example here, and I know this looks sort of frighteningly technical, of an area where on the living wage there is actually some consensus between the brands and the unions and the NGOs. In Turkey, there was what was called the Jo-In initiative, where a number of multi-stakeholder initiatives, together with a number of companies, got together to try and agree first of all on a common code, and then on the basis of that common code to look at specific issues, and living wage was one of them. And what they came up with, and this is in fact a concept that was developed within the FLA,
by a guy called Ruth Tufts, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And this is the Ruth Tufts wage ladder. And those columns there in the middle are six factories which took part in this pilot. And they are the six grading systems operating in those factories. The bottom dashed line is the legal minimum wage in Turkey. The middle line is the government poverty line. And then the other white figures are different trade union assessments of what they see would be. They would argue are the starvation lines or the poverty lines and living wage figures. The beauty of this, I think, is it just helps you conceptualise or graphically see what exists in the country and where you might want to put a target figure. Okay, finally, some targets for the Olympic movement. I think the national organising committees really need to convince the IOC of the need to recognise its overarching responsibility and to adopt a centralised approach on ethical purchasing practices. There has to be a central model. It's an international brand. It just makes eminent sense. But in the meantime, because we've had a letter from the IOC and they're talking about 2016 before they insert any new language into their agreements with host cities, which is ridiculous, really. You could do it tomorrow. But in the meantime, push for the very best practice and social compliance by games organising committees. And I hope that the discussion today will focus very much on that. And with that, over to our division.